At 6:20, this is KERA News. I'm Justin Martin. A special Texas Senate committee looking at school safety had its last public hearing today. As KUT's Claire McInerney reports, the focus was on red flag laws.
First, what is a red flag law? It would allow law enforcement or family members to ask a judge to remove guns from people who are exhibiting signs of hurting themselves or others. A few states already have these laws, including Indiana, Washington, Florida, and California. Today, people advocated for and against this type of law to the Senate Select Committee on Violence in Schools and School Safety. Dana Hoff is a member of the gun control advocacy group Moms Demand Action of Texas. She has a license to carry a handgun in Texas. And Hoff says red flag laws are only for when someone is not in a good mental state.
When a person is undergoing a crisis, a red flag law empowers law enforcement and families to act, providing them with the tool they often feel they lack under the current law.
Many others testified saying red flag laws would infringe on Second Amendment rights by allowing police to confiscate guns without due process.
That was Claire McInerney reporting from Austin. The Trump administration faces a Thursday deadline to reunite migrant families separated at the southern border. In the El Paso area, 500 parents are currently waiting to see their children. Katie Shepard is with the Immigration Justice Campaign. She says these parents will soon be transferred to other centers in Texas where they're expected to be joined by their children.
The fact remains is that family detention is not an appropriate setting for vulnerable asylum seekers, and certainly not for this particularly traumatized population of families who had been previously separated.
The federal government says so far more than 1,100 migrant children have been reunited with family so far. More than 40% of Americans have experienced online harassment. That's according to a 2017 Pew Research study. Agustin Fuentes is a professor of anthropology at Notre Dame. Today on Think, he told Chris Boyd, it's a lot easier to be mean online.
We need to see people and touch people. Humans spend a lot of time in very close contact, and reading interactions by what people's faces and bodies do is as important as understanding what they say. And so when we're online, and this has happened to all of us, someone will type something out and it's misinterpreted. And that becomes really easy. So we become, with the friends we have online, we actually become better writers in some cases, or at least better conveyors of information without the visual. But for our enemies online, or when we get upset, the room for real errors in interpreting what someone means, it's just huge.
Agustin Fuentes' article, Are We As Awful As We Act Online?, appears in National Geographic. This episode of Think rears tonight at 10. On Tuesdays, KERA's One Crisis Away project examines life on the financial edge. Today, a look at the changing middle class, where sometimes even households with six-figure incomes are struggling. The typical American worker puts in 47 hours a week, and nearly 5% work more than one job, with hours that vary depending on the needs of big corporations. Alyssa Cord of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project talked with Courtney Collins on a recent episode of Think about visiting a 24-hour daycare for kids whose parents worked odd hours.
They were nurses' assistants and hospice workers, and they worked evening jobs at Home Depot and stuff like that. And so they'd have to drop off their kids at, 3 o'clock in the afternoon and then come back at 9. And sometimes the kids would have to stay over at the Hogans. That was the name of the family who ran the daycare. And it was part of the whole constellation that I call extreme daycare. Something like 9% of American daycares are now in off hours, like later than working hours on weekends. And that's quite a substantial rise. And even at D's, right across the street, there was another 24-hour daycare.
And we're talking about some of these children literally go to bed and wake up there. And some get picked up close to midnight and they get woken up and put back to bed at home. What is working life like for the parents who send their children there?
That was what I saw. I saw one woman who had two different jobs, and her employers were sort of hiring her for less hours, so they wouldn't, I assume, so they wouldn't have to pay her health insurance. So then she was sort of piecing together two or three different jobs, and they were in strange times. They were kind of at the whim of these conglomerates that were hiring her. So yeah, it was something like, it was 10 in the morning to 3 in the afternoon, and then there'd be a break, and then she'd come back, and then her kids would stay late, and then she'd pick them up very late. And then other kids were staying overnight.
So some of the kids who attended DEES, and they seemed loved and well cared for, you pointed out, but seemed almost a little bit ahead as far as how grown up they were. Describe to me what that kind of child care, what impact does that have on, you know, a preschooler or even a school-age child that's going to sleep somewhere else than home?
I was very impressed, first of all, by the Hogans and also by the kids there. But, you know, I think there is this, you know, parentified, that's what they call it in psychology circles, to describe kids who sort of act older than their years. And that's mostly what I saw. I saw kids who were squeezing the toothpaste tube perfectly when they were five, or they were, you know, they were brushing their hair perfectly. They, you know, they were very well behaved in a way.
In general, though, not everyone requires that kind of care. But how does the cost of childcare influence people's work habits?
One thing I saw when I was interviewing many of these people, you know, that they were working longer hours in order to be able to afford the up to $34,000 in some cases, or even more when there are two children, that they were going to be paying for either a nanny or a daycare facility. So that definitely changed things for them and created a lot of anxiety as well.
Solution-wise, what do you propose? Obviously, if people are spending, you know, 30 or 40% of their income on childcare, or in some cases, I guess a second parent is working just to kind of offset the cost of childcare, how do we fix that?
Well, some of the bespoke solutions that I have in my book, I spent some time with people who are in co-parenting arrangements, which means they are biologically and romantically not linked. They're not lovers and they're not family, but they live in the same house and they care for one another's children collectively. And they do this to save on things like daycare. So that was, you know, a personal solutions, bespoke solutions people have arrived at. But more than that, we need things like universal pre-K or 3K, which we have now in New York City, or, you know, just generalized, you know, better subsidized daycare.
Something I've encountered while reporting a little bit on this topic is even when someone is able to get a subsidy for childcare, which may solve the day-to-day and week-to-week of how they're going to pay for it, sometimes there's a big gap where they have to wait 30 or 60 or 90 days to receive the subsidy. And at that point, the job offer is gone. Is it just so tough to even get your hands on what you've been approved to receive?
Yeah, I mean, that was something I actually saw when I was at the Hogans at the 24-hour daycare. I saw them. I mean, they're really good to the parents. They'd be working with them to try to get their subsidies to kick in. And it was often a struggle. I mean, it's not just the waiting time. It's the forms. It's the bureaucracy. And if you're working all these different jobs, how are you tending to that? That's like a whole other job.
That was Alyssa Korn talking with KERA's Courtney Collins. You can listen to more of their conversation at think.kera.org. And the so-called cold front that's coming will have high temperatures in Texas come down by a few degrees over the next week or so. But make no mistake, it'll still be hot, just not the record-breaking temps we saw in the past 5 days. As the Texas Standard's Michael Marks reports, that kind of heat merits an official warning.
You may have heard the term heat advisory quite a bit during this latest heat wave. It's a notice the National Weather Service sends out to tell people they need to take precautions to stay safe in the heat, especially if they work outside. In the Dallas-Fort Worth area, a heat index of 105 degrees triggers a heat advisory. And the reason it's 105 degrees has to do with geography and, well, you.
Some places, you know, get hotter, and so people are probably a little bit more acclimated to, you know, 105 degrees than other locations in the state, and that's why their threshold is 110.
That's Alex Lister. He's a senior forecaster with the National Weather Service in Midland. When it comes to declaring a heat advisory, there's not a finish line in Texas. It's more like a sliding scale. Generally speaking, the more often and more intense our exposure to heat, the better we can acclimate to it. So, since it tends to be more hot and humid in Houston than, say, the Davis Mountains, you'd expect Houstonians to handle the heat better than those West Texans. It makes sense, then, that the heat advisory threshold in the mountains is a heat index of 100 degrees versus 108 in Houston. There is a condition for this to be true, though. You have to actually go outside. I'm Michael Marks from the Texas Standard.
You could expect mostly clear skies tonight with a low around 78. At 6:30, this is KERA News.